Joining me now is Bill Kleinhardt. The film Project Ice views the Great Lakes through the prism of ice, from the crossroads of history, science, and climate change. It will be shown tonight, Friday night, at 7:30 during the winter's gathering at the North House Folk School here in Grand Marais. Here to tell us more is the film's director and executive producer, Bill Kleinhardt.
Thank you, Dave.
Welcome to the Roadhouse.
It's
welcome to the shore.
To be here. Thank you so much.
You were blown up the shore, I take it.
I was. I just opened my coat, and I was here in a minute.
Yes.
No time to get up the hill.
Well, now you seem to know quite a bit about ice, it would appear. You spent quite a...
Yes. Well, we learned a lot about ice. We were in production and post-production for 27 months. We shot in the winters of 2011, 12, and 13. So we missed this past winter's polar vortex winter, but we ended up with some terrific stuff.
And you've created a documentary called Project Ice.
Yes, and it's a documentary feature. It's just under 2 hours in length, 118 minutes, and we shot on location in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. We had an opportunity to go some places that most people probably don't get to visit, and we wanted to bring that experience to our audience, and we've been pretty successful with it.
Now, let me ask you about the inception of this film. It wasn't your first idea, I take it.
No, well, science was always going to be a part of the film. It was from our earliest outlines, my writing partner and I. He is a historian. His name is Brian Jeske, and he's the Registrar of Historic Collections for the Mackinac State Historic Parks in Michigan, which takes in Mackinac Island and other things around the Straits of Mackinac. But we were originally going to focus on ice breaking and the story of ice breaking, which is an interesting history in and of itself. And he is the foremost expert on that subject. He did his master's dissertation on that subject. So as we, over a several-year period, began trading outlines, my outlines kept getting bigger, taking in more history of the Great Lakes, a wider spectrum of maritime history. And then we got into, we tell the Voyager story quite nicely, I think, quite effectively. So it just kind of grew. And as we were out in the very first winter doing interviews with people, the subject of climate change and global warming kept coming up over and over and over. And, you know, when you get beat over the head enough times with something, even though we had planned that it was going to be part of the story, it became very clear to us that that was the thing that needed to be the emphasis of the film.
And who were you hearing this from when you were out interviewing folks? Was it industry?
It was a wide variety of people, and it wasn't necessarily the scientists who were involved in the film. It was actually after our first winter of shooting that we were introduced to the gentleman who became our science advisor, Dr. Henry Pollack. He's a professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, and he has several distinctions. One is that he is a renowned climatologist, works all over the world, goes to Antarctica usually once or twice a year. He wrote a book called A World Without Ice, which immediately got my attention, as you can imagine. And then I discovered that he shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for his work on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So when he and I met, and I was just meeting with him to try to secure an interview in the film, and he agreed to that. He agreed to come on location with us to do the interview up in the UP, up on the shore of Lake Superior was our first interview to do with him. But then he also very graciously offered to be our science advisor. And that was just a major coup for us. When you have somebody of that caliber get involved with your work, it just, our whole crew, we just kind of ratcheted up our the gravitas, if you will, of what we were doing. So having his involvement changed everything. But it was the non-scientists, so fishermen and a professional dog sled racer and pond hockey players, the mayor of Mackinac Island at the Straits of Mackinac, the famous Mackinac Island, and they were among the many people. We did 25 interviews in the film, and I would say that I'd have to go back and count, but the vast majority of those people brought up climate change and global warming. So we realized that this really needs to be the centerpiece of the film.
Yes, that's amazing that you can respond to that when you start out on a project. You think it's going to go a certain direction, and then you're able to adapt.
I'm a huge believer in that method of doing documentaries. To you can have a general outline, but you need to be listening all along the way and let the story take you where it will. So this was a good example of being able to adjust and adapt to a story that clearly was redirecting us to something more important.
It's a story for everyone too. It's not just
truly
the science and
truly
not just history. It's
yeah.
It's something, you know, and I'm sure you've heard that enough, something for everyone, but
yeah.
The folks, the spectrum of the people that you are presenting, and
yeah.
You know, it's truly amazing.
I give you one example. We have a woman who's a professional musher who's from here in Minnesota. She's from Ray, Minnesota, and she's quite a good dog sled racer, and she came to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to do the UP 200, which is a 200-mile, in this particular year that we did it, it was 240-mile dog sled race over several days' time. And it's a qualifier for the Iditarod as well. So this is a serious race. And up until within even about a week, maybe 10 days at the most, they weren't sure they were going to be able to run the race at all because they lacked snow. And even when they made the commitment to go ahead and hold the race, they had to move the starting point from downtown Marquette to about 25, 30 miles outside of town where they had enough snow to be able to get the race going. So that we experienced the same thing with a large pond hockey tournament that takes place at St. Ignace, just across the Mackinac Bridge in the Upper Peninsula. 160 teams participate in that from literally all over the country and Canada. And they also were not sure that they were going to be able to hold the pond hockey tournament at all. It normally takes place on a harbor at St. Ignace, which is on Lake Huron. And weeks beforehand, they knew that they're not going to have enough ice. So they moved it over to the Lake Michigan side, on the west side of the Mackinac Bridge, to an area where there are some islands just adjacent to the shoreline. And they thought, that'll lock in the ice okay and we'll be safe. They brought their Zamboni over there and they started preparing the ice. And lo and behold, you know, like a day or two into it, they realized, this is not going to work. It's starting to break up. So they had to move to a third location on an inland lake, which worked out fine for them. But there's a degree of disappointment that they can't be out on Lake Huron. Mm-hmm. We also had, I'll give you one last. Normally, an ice bridge forms going from St. Ignace out to Mackinac Island. And when it forms, then people snowmobile back and forth across the island, just about eight miles. Or they take sleighs and horses, and it's, you know, very festive. They have parties out on the ice at that point and the whole nine yards. And in the three winters in which we shot, there was never an ice bridge. Mm. And that was a huge change for them. So when that happens, there's still ice around. But it was a situation where they had to fly now, and they couldn't use the ferries and other means of getting across by snowmobile and sleighs and things. So,
wow. So yeah. Real world effects.
Very much so.
What we often think of as something out there, ambiguous, nebulous,
yeah.
Climate change.
Yes.
It's on the ground, folks.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us here on the Roadhouse, we're speaking with Bill Kleinert. He is in town on a mission. He's got a big, big show. Project Ice is the name of the movie. He's the director, the executive producer. And this movie's been out there a while now, right, Bill? It came out about a year ago or so?
About a year ago. We had our official premiere in Detroit on March 22nd of this year. And we had 800 people at our premiere, our world premiere, and at a very, very neat place, the Detroit Institute of Arts, and their lavish Beaux-Arts 1927-built theater, the Detroit Film Theater. So that was very exciting for us. But we've been doing film festivals. We're in 10 film festivals so far, with, it looks like, several more to come.
Well, and it looks like you've gotten some nice awards from these festivals as well. You've got a PR card here, and we're looking at the
East Lansing Film Festival
Award of
was
Excellence,
our most.
Canada.
Yeah, we won first. We won Award of Excellence for filmmaking for documentaries at the Canada International Film Festival. I went out to Vancouver, British Columbia, to receive that award. That was very exciting. And then just 2 weeks ago, we won the best documentary film at the East Lansing Film Festival held on the Michigan State campus in East Lansing. And that was quite big for us. So we're very excited about that.
Well, you've clearly got a piece of work, a piece of art as well. I understand you filmed this in high-definition cinematography.
Yes,
explain
we did.
Some of
sure,
the shooting
sure, sure.
of this film.
So we shot in a cutting-edge technology that's referred to as 4K, which is a representation of the resolution of the camera. And the resolution is almost five times the resolution of a Blu-ray disc. So it's there's a lot of pixels there, and it's a highly immersive experience when you can see it in a theater where we can give you the full 4K experience. But even in Blu-ray, which we're using tonight, it looks fantastic. So we're very pleased with the outcome. And it's a technology that's been around for a short while, a few years, but it's been used primarily in major studio feature films. And Peter Jackson, the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings director, he was the one that worked with the company Red Digital Cinema to perfect these cameras. We use exactly the same cameras that they were using initially in the Lord of the Rings series. So it's a much more involved process. It takes a bigger crew. We had to invest quite a bit more money in order to use this technology. When our main camera is built, it's 3.5 feet long. So, and it depends on the lens that you have on the front, but with tripod and lens and camera and accessories, you can be looking at something that weighs 80 pounds, 90 pounds in some cases. So you don't just sort of pick it up and say, here we go, you know.
Not if you're going to run across the ice with it, right?
No, we were very careful when we were running across ice with it.
And we ice shot climbing as well?
Yes, we shot ice climbing at Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore at Munising in the Upper Peninsula. That was very exciting. That was one of our most arduous days of shooting because we had to use crampons our whole crew had to be outfitted with crampons, and we had to get instruction. And they tell you now, the way people die when you're wearing these is that you trip and fall over the edge of a, you know, so we were very, very, very careful. No
watch
deaths.
Your step. Watch your step. Well, how about surprises from your film? I mean, the whole thing sounds like a surprise that you end up making it at the end of the day. Anything inside of your studies? Any insights into global warming, climate change?
Yeah, I think a number of things. I learned how impactful it's been in so many different ways, economic ways, due to the decreased drafts. What's happening is when there is not ice cover present, then there is greater evaporation taking place, and that's when you've seen the dramatic drops in lake levels here in Lake Superior in particular. And when that happens, then the large bulk ore carriers, the bulk carriers that are carrying iron ore, taconite and coal and grains and so on, they have to decrease the load they can take on a given trip. So that means in order to get that same quantity of material to its end user, they have to make more trips. So there's more expense, there's more fuel expended, there's more pollution put into the air. So that's there, you know, costs, very tangible costs to that. It also affects the fisheries. When ice is not present, certain species, in particular whitefish, their spawning beds are left exposed to the wave action that's occurring in the winter. When there's ice cover present, it gives them a much more stable spawning ground. But when it's not there, then waves kick up and you have a reduction in the fishery the following spring. Likewise, this is sort of a double-edged sword. When ice is present and stable during the winter, it provides a buffer to winter storms along the shoreline, so there's less erosion that takes place. Conversely, with a winter like last winter, and perhaps what we're about to experience again, one of these extreme events, then you can get damage to shorelines from too much ice being present, too. There's still study that needs to take place as far as whether or not what we saw last winter could be an example of an extreme event that has also been influenced by climate change. The jury is still out on that a bit. But clearly, last winter was an outlier in the data. We look at 40 years of data on temperature in the Great Lakes Basin, and we look at 40 years of ice cover and duration. So you have a graphic with it going up left to right for temperature, and conversely, you have ice cover and duration going down from left to right on that same type of graph. That's absolutely indisputable. And there will always, as even in those in the data that we plotted, there were always years within that line that were higher temperatures or lower temperatures than average, and same with ice cover. But those are the outliers. The trend is one that you look at over a long period of time, and that's indisputable.
Did you find any hope?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a parent. We have two boys who are in college, and I feel a tremendous responsibility that we have to do all that we can to try to contain our consumption of fossil fuels, which is what's causing the greenhouse gases to accumulate in the atmosphere and resulting in global warming. So I feel this tremendous moral obligation that I think that we all have to do something about this. And it's going to require some major changes in lifestyle and major changes just in the way that we power the things that we all want. We all want heat. We all want lights. We all want air conditioning in certain circumstances. But there are alternatives to fossil fuels to still provide us with those not necessarily luxuries, but necessities of our life as we've come to know it. And, you know, we evolved into this over a long period of time. We didn't just, you know, say, oh, let's pollute with greenhouse gases. It took us a long period of time and took us a longer period of time to understand what the real impacts and consequences were of our consumption of those types of fuels. So I am encouraged that so many people are focusing on this now.
Are there models that can project if you change, then, you know, it'll turn out okay? Is there any?
There's, yeah, well, it's a good question. It's a really good question.
If there are, just let's move on.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of speculation about it. Some people feel that we're very close to a tipping point from which we cannot return.
I've heard that.
And that's going to require a lot more adaptation on our part, adapting to a warmer climate, adapting to higher sea levels, and other things like we've experienced here in the lakes. But I like to think that if we take the proper steps over the next 20 to 50 years, hopefully yet during most of my lifetime, that we can do something very positive about this.
Well, I'm sure that's why this film is out there. I know it's got to be a strong statement of advocacy and scenery.
Yeah, the pictures are really gorgeous, if I don't say so myself. So,
well, we're talking Project ICE with Bill Kleinert. He's the director. He's the executive producer. The film is showing tonight at the North House Folk School. It's part of the Winter's Gathering. And Arctic Film Festival. Thank you, Bill. One last question. Mm-hmm. What was your favorite shooting location?
What a great question. I would say either at Whitefish Point, at the mouth of Whitefish Bay on the far eastern end of Lake Superior. That was the most dramatic ice that we shot. We were literally on ice where we were 30 feet above the water level, and just dramatic in color and textures and everything. And then the other place was going to the top of the Mackinac Bridge Towers, and we were 585 feet above the water level, and it was a real journey just to get to the top of the bridge. So.
And did they sway in the wind?
It first, when we first got up there, we were up there for about 3.5 hours. And when we first got up there, there was no wind.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad of that, because by the end there was wind and we were moving. But by that point, we were kind of acclimated being up there. But that first moment when you pop through the final hatch that you have to go through, and your head is looking out, that's your holy, you know, that's your aha moment.
That'll make you feel small.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us on
Thank
the Roadhouse.
Dave. Thank you.